we'll take this one-dimensional way of thinking about kids, we'll carve it up into a category, and we'll say, this defines the kid. That average person doesn't actually exist. It's a false reference point. It causes all kinds of problems when it comes to understanding people.
Below average what? Why don't we call them above average in love?
Parents hear it from the first day they have a child. Teachers don't want to be below it. As a person, you don't want to really be labeled as it. We're talking with a not average at all professor at Harvard, Todd Rose, next.
And now, it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, yep. Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep. First name Bentley, last name Brothers, bringing education information like no others. Yep. With Tim and Scott, you know what you got, innovation in education.
That's right, Scott. We got Todd Rose with us today. We're so privileged to have him on the show. He's the director of the Mind, Brain, and Education program at Harvard. He's the leader for the Laboratory for the Science of the Individual, and he runs a nonprofit. It's the Center for Individual Opportunity. He's also the author of a couple of best-selling books, including his latest called The End of Average. And we're going to be talking about that today. Todd, welcome to the Bentley Brothers.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Why don't you just kick it off and give us a brief synopsis of what is The End of Average and why would a teacher be interested in reading your book?
So in a nutshell, it's this. For about the last 100 years, we've built our social systems, including education, around the idea that you could understand and nurture kids through the use of averages. So you understand a kid as a type or how far they deviate from average, so like their GRE score or SAT score. And that got us a long way in the industrial age, but it turns out to be spectacularly wrong. There's literally no such thing as an average kid. And rather than being a bumper sticker slogan, it has deep scientific importance, and I think it has practical importance for the classroom if our goal is to nurture and develop every kid.
Todd, with that in mind, like how do we get away from those labels of average or being above average or below average or things like that? I mean, is that even possible with the system that we've created?
You know, I'm not sure it's possible within the existing system as it's structured. And I think you're seeing a lot of people pushing back against the kind of batch processing sort of normative approach to education that we've seen. And it shows up in whether we're talking about personalized learning or student-centered learning or a whole range of names. But I think we have to make some pretty fundamental changes to the architecture of the system. But I think the good news is that it'll get us a lot closer to a school system that most teachers really want and sort of the kind of education system they dreamed of when they wanted to be teachers.
And so this idea of just grouping kids and saying this group is average and you're above average, you're below average, using whatever standard that we are, how does that show up in schools and in education? Can you be like more specific that what do teachers do, what do parents do, how do kids treat it that is a result of that type of thinking?
Yeah, sure. So let's just step through some basic things about the system. So, you know, we base kids on age, right? We have cohorts of age, and we think that's roughly close enough. We will give kids a fixed amount of time to learn, which is actually based like standardized assessments. Have you ever wondered who decided how long a kid gets to take that test, right? It's actually the average time it takes kids in a group, a sample, when they created the test to begin with, right? With the idea that fast is smart and slow isn't smart. So let's just peg it to the average and call it fair. But then if you start thinking about even closer to the way kids view themselves, so we'll call a kid gifted and we'll shower them with more resources if they deviate from the national average on a test by a certain number of standard deviations, right? And then you'll see things like in some schools where kids are on the wait list for giftedness, which is kind of a weird thing, but you know. And then on the other extreme, we'll call a kid disabled. We'll say you have a learning disability, like you might have dyslexia, and it's really because you are, you know, two standard deviations below the average for your age at this kind of reading. And it's like, we'll take this one-dimensional way of thinking about kids, we'll carve it up into a category, and we'll say this defines the kid. I understand why we do it. I understand what it bought us, but I think most teachers, parents, even administrators think that we want to be shifting toward a school system whose goal is to nurture and develop kids. And if that's true, then you've got to actually know more about individual kids to be able to do that. And averages just fail.
Yeah. So on a practical level, I'm sitting in my classroom right now, Todd. And I think about, you know, how do I communicate this concept with parents when they're looking at, you know, grades, and that's how we report to them on how students do, is your students either, well, C is not even really acceptable anymore, right? So we're going by the master's standards now. You have to have a B or higher or whatever. So how do we communicate that with parents so they really understand that we as teachers need to look at students individually rather than on averages?
Yeah. So I think, personally, I think teachers are in the toughest spot right now of anybody, right? Which is, like, intuitively you grasp, like, this is how you should think about kids and you want to nurture them. But the system that wraps around you is actually not built for that, right? And so you end up, you know, we'll talk about, you could say, you know, Johnny is doing okay over here, not so good over here. Let's talk about this whole kid. But at the end of the day, the system is going to say, what's the kid's score? And I think that I personally believe it's on people like me who are saying the system is not working the way we want it to actually do the work to try to make, give people tools and change the mindset of the public to make it easier for teachers to actually do their job. So I think it's you can have the conversation with kids. You can talk about it that way. There is an importance just seeing your kid as what we call like a whole child and so this, but fully appreciating that as we're saying this, we're sitting in a system that absolutely works against that in every chance it gets.
And so we have to report to parents. And so one of the tools that we obviously use to communicate with parents is the report card. And from what I'm hearing, you're saying that things like that, like a report card in the traditional sense of it doesn't even have to be letter grades. I mean, we're asked to grade our kids now on 3 means mastery, 2 plus, 2, 2 minus means approaching mastery, and a 1 means they're not getting it, you know? So, I mean, even to come up with those scores, first of all, they're somewhat arbitrary, and then we have to
I like how you said somewhat arbitrary.
I was about to say, probably not somewhat, but completely arbitrary. And then we have to use some sort of an averaging to say, well, mastery in my class means that they're really doing better than the other kids in the class, right?
Yeah.
And so do we continue to use report cards? How do we, you know, if you were to create the perfect system with this concept in mind, how do we communicate with parents? How do we fulfill that part of our job if we're not going to give them a report card in the traditional sense?
Yeah, and I'll say, I think it's really important that we understand how kids are progressing against the kinds of things we want them to learn. And I think that, so I'm in favor of that. And I think they do need to be referenced against some kind of, like, what is it they're trying to learn? And I actually don't care, you know, with my 2 sons, I could care less how they compare relative to the person sitting next to them, right? So as long as we're not talking about relative comparison as a way to understand what the kid knows, I'm fine. The biggest problem is that from a scientific standpoint, the second you try to reduce a kid into a single dimension, you're just always wrong. So you get a little more new. I mean, you just can't do it. And so what we've been looking at is, I mean, the approach, the shift to things like portfolio-based assessments and things that give kids lots of ways to demonstrate competence instead of this one test, this one way. But I will say what's great about what you're asking is, I think assessments are the hardest thing to figure out, right? And like, they often flow from an acceptance of a way of thinking and a pedagogy that's put in place. And then you have to think about, well, how do we measure the outcomes? So for me, I think it's, I still think the public has an old view of what kids are capable of that keeps reinforcing, well, only some kids can be excellent and most kids are mediocre. So on my end, we're putting a lot of time into thinking about broader social movements to convince parents and the general public that there's a better way to think about people.
So when you say the end of average, you're not saying that you want to get rid of mediocrity. You're saying that you want to get rid of the concept of average.
Yeah, it's what's so hard about it is that it's the idea of average as a reference point has seeped into our culture. It literally influences everything from the way we've created our jobs and how we assess performance to how we'll educate, even to how we've done healthcare and medicine for a long time. And so it seems so obvious that you can see a bell curve in your head and like, you know, the middle is like most people. And what I'm arguing is from a scientific standpoint, when it comes to human beings, that average person doesn't actually exist. It's a false reference point that causes all kinds of problems when it comes to understanding people.
Yeah, apparently my son is only 25% of the weight that he should be, right. Except for that he runs around all the time, and he's, you know, so he's going to be okay, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I had my goddaughter when she was just about a year or so old. Their parents took her to a pediatrician, and they were like, "Oh, she should have 16 words by now." And I was like, they came back and said, "Why 16 words?" It's like, because on average, this is how many words. It's like, and they actually said, "Well, look, if she doesn't pick it up a bit, we might consider remediation." And I just was like, "Just stop." Oh, like, and of course, now she is the most eloquent, chatty little girl you'll ever meet. But it's like this all of like, on average, at this age, this is what kids should do. And we feel comfortable as parents thinking it feels safe to know there's some reference point there. But, you know, look, it just from a scientific standpoint, it doesn't work, and we have a better way to do things. And my argument is that better way to do things in terms of focusing on individuality makes for a better foundation for education in the workplace.
Yeah, that's one of my passions. One of the things that just gets me going is just thinking about how we label people with special needs, you know, maybe someone with Down syndrome or whatever. And we say, well, they're below average in this or whatever. And it's like, oh my gosh, when you see the love that comes out of those people and the difference that they make in this world, why in the world are we worried about that kind of stuff? You know, I mean, it's like below average, what? Why don't we call them above average in love? Right. You know?
Yeah, no, because we basically reduced all of like human potential to some narrow description that's based on academic performance in a few areas, and then everything else doesn't matter, right? My view is, look, it's not that everyone's a genius, but it is that we have no idea what people are really capable of because we've never built systems that bet on them, that really work to get the most out of each and every individual. And I think we have a unique opportunity now because economically we need an incredibly diverse array of talents, like more than we've ever needed in the history of our country. And so we've got to figure out how to get the most out of people. And I think the good news for me is when I was writing the book, I thought it would be an abstract idea and there wouldn't be a lot of solutions. And I was really pleased to look when I looked in workplace, when I looked in education, there's plenty of people who understand this and who are pushing hard with solutions. But right now they're all on the fringes of the system that's average based. So I see as my job to help to change the public mindset to say, to soften the ground so that when parents and the public look at what great teachers are doing in the name of focusing on individual kids, it won't seem like they're just trying to level the playing field, or it will see the logic of it, right? Right. And I think without doing that, I think it's going to be hard to get the ship steered the way we want it to go.
Todd, I think some of the teachers listening right now are probably thinking, hey, isn't a lot of the testing and scores that get us to look at averages, grades, things like that, aren't those really just measures of accountability for the adults in the system rather than the students?
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. So think like when you look at whenever we use group averages and deviation from average, those numbers can be useful when the focus is on the system as a whole, right? So like if I'm a sociologist, averages and deviation from average are fantastic metrics, right? And if I wanted to look at the functioning of the school system across the nation, with a little bit of nuance, I would still probably use group averages and deviation from average. And I think the difference is, it's like for us as people who care about individuals, for teachers who care about individuals, those kind of metrics are not helpful at all. It doesn't tell us what we do next to actually help the kid.
Now, I want to ask you a selfish question here. This is for my own purposes. So do we group kids? Do we level kids in the classroom? Do we have a high achieving math group and a middle math group and a lower math group in order to meet the kids' needs better? Or is that using averages and messing them up? I mean, what's your opinion on something like that from being an expert on this?
Well, I can tell you my opinion on it. You're all the experts in the actual practice, so I don't want to overstep, but I think when I've seen it work historically, there's a number of ways it can work, right? And when you have to group, which look, at the end of the day, it's really hard to imagine 30 kids on their own. And I'm not even sure we'd want that, right? Like there's a social element to learning. But when you're able to group, as long as it's not like this kid is in the high group, period, right? Like, and then these kids are, we're all AP students, and versus like right now, where you are in algebra, this is the grouping that makes the most sense, where you're going to have kids that are roughly in your same range and can interact. But like the next subject or even the next part of the math is not necessarily the same, right? It's like, so it's like, but as you know, like in a classroom, it's crazy the amount of range that you see in terms of where kids are. I don't know how you do it, frankly. I really don't.
Yeah. Like, me either.
We don't.
So I'm a big fan of this kind of like more dynamic groupings that are just more about, it's not about anything innate about the kid. It's just like, hey, right now this is where you're at. And when you look at some of the science that I talk about in the book around pacing, one of I think the most important thing that people could realize is Edward Thorndike, who was the father of educational psychology and standardized most of the early system of education, deeply believed that fast brains were smart brains, and that there was like a one-to-one correlation there between how fast you could learn something and how smart you would be. And so we standardized the system of like, if this is how what you should know at this age, and if you don't, then you're behind, and this is how long it should take you to learn in this class, and if you don't, you just don't know that much. And if you think about it, like that is still baked into everything, right? So if I said, oh, Tim, you're a quick learner, you think I'm saying you're smart, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even though I've not said anything about that, but what we know for sure from the research is there is absolutely no relationship between pace and ability. So like, and we've known that since Benjamin Bloom and his mastery work, right? If you give kids a little bit of time and some flexibility there, what one kid can do, most kids can do. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I think it's important when we do dynamic groupings is there's a way that that's interpreted. It's not that, hey, you're in the slow group because you're dumb. No, it's just like right now, this is where you're at. And it doesn't matter that you're in this group that's a little bit behind. You're fully capable of becoming the smartest kid in the class at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, growth mindset. And we, in elementary school, we call it flexible grouping. Mm. When the kids can move in and out of whatever groups, you know, and everything. So great stuff, Todd. I could pick your brain all day long, but we're at the part of the show. We're going to switch gears with you a little bit and play a game. So Todd, you're the best-selling author of The End of Average. And so we thought we'd play a little game with you that we're calling Average Smaverage. And you will try to answer some questions about the average person, which I know you totally believe in. Right? Scott, tell our audience who Todd will be playing for today.
Todd, you'll be competing for Dean Meyer in Michigan. If you're able to answer 2 out of 3, yes, a little bit above average, Dean will be awarded a free download of an album by the ridiculously popular edgy rock band Rockin' the Standards.
Nice. And Dean, I'm sorry in advance.
Yeah, so we're going to test your knowledge on averages, on the average person, okay? So question number one is this. How much total food did the average American eat in 2011? Total food. Is it A?
Just short of 1 ton.
Or is it B?
About 350 pounds.
Or is it C?
Over 5,000 pounds.
All right. So your three choices are the average American in 2011. That's the last time we can pull up the stats on that. Ate just short of a ton. About 350 or over 5,000 pounds.
How about just short of a ton?
Just short of a ton. Well, that is correct. Okay, you got one right. Number two. According to a 2004 German study, the average adult laughs how many times per day? The average adult laughs how many times per day? Is it A?
Negative 500. Oh, sorry. No, wait. That's not it.
That's the German adult. Right?
Sorry, Germany. A is 20 times per day.
Or is it B?
50 times per day.
Or is it C?
100 times per day. Well, that would be our average today, right, Tim?
When we're doing a show, we get about 100 times. Yeah, is it 20, 50, or 100 times per day?
Boy, I'd like to say it's a lot, but I feel like I'm going to be pretty negative here. I think it's about 20 times a day.
20 times per day. That is correct. All right. Well, a little bit of background on that. Laugh expert Robert Provine, who has studied laughter for 30 years, explained that the average adult laughs around 20 times a day. A German study conducted in 2004 indicates a single bout of laughter, meaning a laugh that occurs in a single exhalation, occurs an average of 5.8 times in a 10-minute period during normal conversations. Speakers in a conversation laugh more often on their own sentence after their own sentence rather than somebody else's. So you laugh at yourself. Studies show that the average four-year-old, now talk about average, laughs 300 times per day.
Wow.
So we need to be more like four-year-olds, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Question number three.
I laugh at other people's sentences. As I laugh at my own.
Yeah, exactly. We laugh at ourselves all the time. How many times a day can an average American citizen be caught on camera? Caught on camera. Is it A?
More than 12 times a day.
Or is it B?
More than 29 times a day.
Or is it C?
More than 75 times a day. And I think whatever you answer, you get that one right, right? If it's more than.
Yeah, that's true.
That's, so I'm going to go ahead and say it's more than 12 since just the logic there.
Well, let's just change the answer to about 12 times a day. Actually, the answer is more than 75 times a day.
Which is also more than 12.
Which is more than 12. Okay. You probably don't even notice it happening, from your neighbor's home surveillance to traffic cameras to hidden lenses in the office elevator. Tracking your whereabouts isn't hard with recent advancements in surveillance technology. It's everywhere. We're being watched by the traffic light cameras and all kinds of stuff. So anyway, 75 times a day. Scott, how did Todd do on today's show?
Awesome job, Todd. You got 3 out of 3 correct. Way above average.
Woo-hoo.
And that's good enough to be a winner. Congratulations, Todd. You've won absolutely nothing. But Dean, he just won a free download of Rockin' the Standards album, Education Rock and Roll Music for 2nd through 6th grade teachers and students, really.
Nice. All right. So, wow, I sure hope we can get you on the show again, because I feel like we've got about 10 shows that we could do with you and still be like not getting to the bottom of all this stuff that is so good, such huge implications for teachers. Can you tell your new fans here of our show how they can get a hold of you in the future?
Sure. Just my webpage is toddrose.com.
Okay. And there's two D's in Todd.
Two D's. Yep.
Right. And are you on Twitter?
Yes, at L Todd Rose.
Great. We totally appreciate you being on the show. And Scott, you want to mention real quickly Global School Play Day?
Yeah. If you haven't heard of it yet, then this is probably the first time you listen to the show. But Tim and I and a group of really amazing teachers put together and educators put together a day we call Global School Play Day. It's meant to bring as much awareness as we can to the fact that kids just aren't given the time to have unstructured play. And we really want to bring that back, not just on this day, but we would like to have it every day for kids. And so the first Wednesday in February, if you want to go to globalschoolplayday.com and sign your class up. Last year we had over 177,000 students from around the world sign up in just the second year of this. So this is ringing true out there. Let's get kids out playing healthy and, you know, becoming more empathetic, better problem solvers, all the benefits that come with that unstructured play.
Definitely. All right, and if you have time, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, on Podomatic, and if you can write us a review, that would be awesome. And unless you don't like the show, then you probably don't want to do that. And thanks so much for watching, everybody, and thanks for watching.
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Bedley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bedley Brothers, Bedley, Bedley.